We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Starting in June of 2007, photographer and filmmaker Tim Hetherington and journalist Sebastian Younger began spending time with a group of American soldiers stationed in a remote area of eastern Afghanistan. They made 10 trips on assignment for Vanity Fair magazine and ABC News. They lived with the men. They went on patrol with them. They came back with 150 hours worth of material. After the deployment ended, they also shot individual interviews with some of the soldiers. And they took all of this material and they made a documentary titled Restrepo, and that's the name the soldiers gave to their outpost there in Afghanistan. They named it in honor of their medic who was killed in action early on in the deployment. The film won the Grand Jury Prize for Documentary at this year's Sundance Film Festival, and it will be shown for the first time on television next Monday. This is November 29th on the National Geographic Channel. That'll be 8 o'clock Central Time. In addition, Tim Hetherington has published a book of photographs that he made while he and his partner were filming Restrepo. That book is titled Infidel, and also Sebastian Younger has published a new book based on the reporting that he did there. That book is titled War. They're both joining us by telephone this morning to talk about Restrepo. We're very pleased to have them as guests. Questions from listeners are welcome. We hope people will be brief and be on the topic, but of course, your input is welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, Mr. Hetherington, hello.
Hey, good afternoon.
Thanks very much for talking with us. And Sebastian Younger, hello.
Hi there.
Great to have you both. We certainly appreciate it. Just maybe as a way to start, it would be good to set the scene a little bit for us. This takes place in a place in Afghanistan called the Korangal Valley. Where is that and what was its strategic importance?
The Korangal was in eastern Afghanistan in Kunar province, about 20 miles from the Pakistan border. We were with a company of soldiers, 150 soldiers, battle company of the 173rd Airborne. No one going out there, including Tim and myself, really had heard of the Korangal or knew what the significance of it. It was the scene, it would be the scene of a fifth of all the combat in all of Afghanistan. Keep in mind the valley is only 6 miles long. It was the guys we were with were in something like 400 firefights during their deployment. It was a very intense place.
So clearly, this was at the time, this was one of the most, maybe the most dangerous place to be in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it was really a kind of epicenter of fighting going on, and it wasn't just the kind of the Taliban from southern Afghanistan. You know, this was a local Taliban, and there were foreign insurgents, people from the Hezbollah Islami group or the Haqqani network. You know, there were Pakistanis, Arabs, Chechens, Uzbeks fighting there. So in terms of when we think about the Afghan war and the way that the Taliban is allied to kind of al-Qaeda, this is the kind of groups that we're seeing fighting in the Korangal Valley.
Yeah, and it's you know, some of the comments you have the soldiers talking about what their first impressions of the place were, and it wasn't much. They talk about feeling that truly this was the middle of nowhere. And also that clearly being there, they were extremely vulnerable.
Yeah, it really shocked the guys. You know, I'd been with Battle Company in 05 in Zabul province, which is sort of more of a moonscape. That's what I think a lot of Americans imagine Afghanistan to be. This looked like Colorado. I mean, there were huge, huge trees on the upper ridges and these rivers, steep mountains. We were at 5,000 feet and on up to about 10,000 feet. It was really rugged territory, and you have to remember, I mean, the guys we were with were young and extremely fit guys, but they were carrying, you know, upwards of 100, sometimes 120, up to 150 or 160 pounds of gear on their back. So, you know, they took one look at those mountains and realized that they really had a hell of a job in front of them.
Yeah, so even if nobody was shooting at you, just living there and working in that environment would be very physically demanding.
Oh, yeah. When we first got up to the outpost, Restrepo, you know, they were starting to build it, and there was no running water or electricity up there. There was no internet. You know, there was no hot showers. There was no cooked food. You know, you were living out in the open. And I remember once when it rained, there was no shelter. And eventually you got a generator up there. But it was the most basic conditions, and you know, they were living and fighting at that altitude. You know, I remember one day we were there. The outpost was attacked four times in a day, but the record was 14 times. And so it was a rugged and tough place to be. But it was the best place to be if you were interested in the experience of what combat is like. And that's what the film and our books are about.
Yeah, you set out. I think the idea was that what you wanted to do was follow a particular group of soldiers, and to be able to do that, at least touch base with them for some extended periods of time all the way through their deployment, and that means a little more than a year, 15 months. I don't think, and you can tell me, but I don't think anybody had done this before.
I don't think they had. I mean, to us, it was just such an interesting and obvious idea, but we wanted to pick one platoon, 30 men, in a remote outpost, not on a big base, but in a really remote place, and follow them and see what their life was like. Tim and I did a total of 5 one-month trips each. Sometimes we were together, sometimes we were apart. We both did all of the filming. We followed that up with some interviews in Italy, at their base in Italy, after the deployment, where they could talk with more openness and emotionality about their experience out there. You know, at Restrepo, they couldn't really afford to do that. But they, you know, within a couple of trips, they really got to know us very well. We became part of that platoon. By the third trip, I think we were completely accepted. And so, I mean, the firefights, you know, that footage is, you know, pretty stunning, I think. I mean, it's just so dramatic. But for us, what really was the value of this is that the guys really opened up to us and sort of explained what it felt like to be out there. I mean, we were very, very lucky to be with them.
Yeah. Well, I think it's true that the footage of firefights that you have is very dramatic, and we can talk about that. I think, though, one of the things that you learn is that when you're in a situation like this, yes, it's very dangerous, and yes, there at the times when the enemy is trying to kill you, but there are also times when really you're sitting around, you're not doing anything. I'm sure that you alternate between these very intense periods of action and periods of really crushing boredom.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there were weeks when there was no fighting, when, say, if the insurgents were getting a resupply of ammunition, the fighting would die down. And then the kind of attention that is normally directed out to the fighting was kind of directed in on the group. And, you know, it was a really interesting kind of thing to be a part of, to see this kind of real male energy there. And, you know, it was funny because we're talking about brotherhood, not necessarily friendship. I mean, one of the guys in the platoon said, you know, there are guys in this platoon that downright hate each other, but we would all die for each other. And so, I said, we're not talking about friendship, we're talking about a brotherhood. And that was a very interesting thing to be a part of. And as Sebastian said, we became, to all intents and purposes, part of the platoon, although we never carried a weapon and we never pulled guard duty, although someone used to try and wake me up in the middle of the night to see if I'd do that.
Mm-hmm. Had you thought about what would happen, or can you imagine yourself being in that position where things would get so bad that you would have to pick up a gun and start shooting?
I thought about it a lot. I think Tim did too. Chosen Company, you know, a couple of allies to the north, the sister company, they were in three huge firefights, and their casualties, you know, they were, each one they had 50% casualties up to 100%. They sent out a patrol at one point, 28-man patrol. They got ambushed, and within a few minutes, every guy in the patrol was down with a bullet in them. The wounded fought off the Taliban and were finally rescued. So, you know, clearly if I had been, or Tim and I had been in that situation, you know, we would have at least been helping tend the wounded. And, you know, yeah, I mean, there's a very strict journalistic ethic about not carrying a weapon, not using weapons. You're covering the story. You're not part of it. But there's a point where survival is in question, and then I think any person would do anything to help and to survive.
Well, certainly, and you were exposed to a danger, and when you see these the shots of the firefights where people are running around and yelling and bullets are flying all around and people are shooting and you don't really know where the people who are shooting at you are, and then you're there, or whoever has the camera, you're there right in the middle of it, and I'm thinking that, you know, that, not that it ever would have been me, but I'm thinking, well, you're lugging this camera around, you're trying to shoot it, but the bullets are flying, and you could get shot just as easily as one of these guys could get shot.
Yeah, I mean, making the film was a feat in itself. I mean, I can't think of many films were actually made with what you could carry on your back. There was no road up to Restrepo. We had to we had to walk up the mountain, and so we had to carry the kid up there. And in the firefights, we had to carry the kid and be filming. And it was a very dangerous place. I mean, there were a number of men that were killed and wounded out there. And both Sebastian and I, you know, obviously there were times when we came close to being killed ourselves. Sebastian was in a Humvee that was blown up. Luckily, I would say he had the camera running. Well, that sounds kind of weird to say, but and luckily the bomb went off underneath the engine block, and nobody in the Humvee was killed or wounded. But it made remarkable scene. I myself was on the American lines when they were overrun by insurgents. You know, guys were killed at close range. It was a terrible scene up there during Operation Rock Avalanche. And interestingly enough, that was the same operation that Sal Junta, a member of 1st Platoon, in Battle Company, where he carried out the action for which he was just been awarded the Medal of Honor. So it was an up close fight. And as Sebastian said, there were moments where, you know, I remember the possibility of the outpost being overrun was a distinct possibility.
Let me just introduce quickly our two guests, Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Unger. Tim is the last you heard speaking. He's a photographer, filmmaker. He has quite a lot of experience in covering conflict. He made a film about the Civil War in Liberia. He's contributing photographer for Vanity Fair magazine. Sebastian Unger is contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He's covered, reported from a number of war zones around the world. Probably a lot of people will know him for his book, The Perfect Storm. Together, they have made a documentary. The title of the film is Restrepo. It won the Best Documentary Award at Sundance this year. It is among the films now that has made the short list from which Academy Award nominees for documentaries will be pulled. And it's going to have its premiere on television, be shown on television for the first time on the National Geographic Channel next Monday. This is the 29th of November. Questions are welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. So I guess, Sebastian, that you were the guy early on in the film. One of the first things that happens is you, as viewer, you feel like you're sitting in this armored vehicle and you're riding along with the guy. So apparently that was you who was holding the camera when it gets hit by the IED. And then it's just chaos, and there's yelling, and there's people are running around, and people are shooting. And that seems that's representative of the kind of thing that then you see later with various instances of combat. Is it truly that chaotic?
Well, God, I mean, it's chaotic like football's chaotic. You know what I mean? Like, there's a plan, there's a process. The guys are very well drilled in it, but also anything can happen. And so the two kind of go along side by side in weird ways. The guys are very well programmed to react to combat in specific ways, that where each position, each gun reinforces everyone else. All that on paper works on paper, and they carry that out to an amazing degree in the firefights. But you know, combat is also all about mistakes and randomness and bad luck. And, you know, the batteries go down on a radio, and then suddenly someone can't communicate with someone else, and then all of a sudden the battle falls apart. So it was sort of both things at the same time.
Mm-hmm. It seems to be the case that, early in the movie there's one of the figures, the captain there, talks about how he comes into this situation. And the person who had been there before had said, you know, it said something like, well, we take fire every day. And this fellow, this is Dan Kearney, says something like, well, he thought that was crazy, taking fire every day. His thing was, well, we're going to go out and we're going to find the enemy and we're going to kill him. And we're not going to do that. But it seems to me that, you know, if you ask, well, what it is they're there for, it almost starts to seem that actually they're there to get shot at. That is, to put themselves out there, to offer themselves as potential targets, to draw the enemy so that then they can engage the enemy. So in some weird way, it almost makes it seem like their purpose is to get shot at.
Well, I mean, you know, as the sergeant major in the company says, he says sometimes you got to go and reach out to the enemy. I mean, if they stayed always in their bases, then the insurgents were going to come up and attack the bases, and they stand a greater chance of being overrun. The idea was you had to go out of the bases, go out on patrols every day, and push back and create what Kearney calls a white space. white space where, you know, you're going down in the villages and you're kind of, you're claiming that territory, although eventually you come back to your bases. And that's just the way that military tactics work. If you stay in your bases, you're eventually going to get overrun. You've got to go out there and you've got to reach out to the enemy, and therefore you're going to put yourself in harm's way.
The logic of their presence in the Korangal, I should just explain it quickly. I mean, in terms of the U.S. military thinking was, I mean, the Korangal was 6 miles long. It was not, it had no inherent importance, but it was being used as a base by insurgents that were attacking the Pesh River Valley, which was a large valley just to the north. It was a major mobility corridor. It was actually quite a, demographically a very, quite an important place. So they were trying to, the U.S. military was trying to pave the, a road through the Pesh to bring in commerce, to bring in a rule of law and government. They couldn't do it because they were getting attacked so continually from the insurgents' base in the Korangal. So they're like, okay, we're going to put a base in the Korangal. It worked. I mean, the attacks on the Pesh stopped. It all got, all the attacks started to focus on the American bases in the Korangal. And so, and it did to us too when we were out there. It looked completely pointless. Like, why are you fighting here? Like, there's nothing here. There was a larger kind of logic to it that is not apparent from being there, and it's, we don't make it clear in the film because the soldiers didn't really dwell at that higher level. They were focused completely on what was in front of them.
Well, when you're, I'm sure when you're in that situation, that's what you have to do. You, from one day to the next, your main objective is, well, first of all, stay alive, and then do the job that you have been tasked to do, probably the best you can possibly do it, and stay alive. C number one is being the most important thing.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like, cops, you know, the police are out there doing their job, just as the fire brigade go and do that. They don't kind of talk about necessarily the politics of the bigger picture or why they're doing it. They're tasked with going down on that beat and, you know, or policing that precinct. And that's it's much the same with soldiers and their work.
But it did seem that there was more, and maybe that what happened here when you got a chance, when the deployment was over and they went back to Vicenza, the place where they were based, and so you had an opportunity to sit down in a kind of a studio setting and do one-on-ones in a way that you couldn't do when they were there, that there did seem to be... They did talk about the fact that must have been when they were there. There were times when they thought to themselves, what are we doing here?
I think they did ask that of themselves, but there's a lot of tasks in the Army that, from the soldier's perspective, don't make much sense. I mean, imagine what Dunkirk looked like to the American British soldiers in World War II. That's on an enormous scale. So soldiers know that they don't have the big picture. They know that sometimes their unit is exposed or sacrificed for a small piece of ground so that some other unit can do something else that they don't even know about. That's part of being a soldier. It's part of that reality. And I think the soldiers understand that. It doesn't make it any less painful for them, but I think they do kind of get that in the abstract.
Yeah. Did you get some kind of sense of who these guys were and how it is that they came to be in the Army?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what makes the film really unique is the level of intimacy that we got with the soldiers. I mean, it was one of the most profound things, really, for Sebastian and I, was becoming part of the group and being accepted into the group. And, you know, especially as you mentioned the Italy interviews, you know, I would say that we filmed the Verite, and then because we were taking it from the grunt's eye view of the war, you know, we went back to Italy and we actually sewed together the Verite with these kind of post-deployment interviews. And we went to Italy not as the kind of company shrink, not as authority figures, not as their parents or family to whom they have difficulty in relating events. We went as friends who could talk about these things. And they really opened up to us with the kind of thoughtfulness that you rarely see. What we learned was, I mean, they joined the military for all sorts of reasons. It's neither that they just joined it out of patriotic duty or out of economic necessity. They joined it for a mixture of that, and a lot of them joined it out of a desire to be in a combat unit. They want to serve. It's a volunteer army, and the unit we're with, the Airborne, is a well-respected unit in the U.S. military. I mean, guys can join the military and, fix up Humvees if they want. It's pretty easy to get yourself into that position. But these guys wanted to see combat, and they wanted to serve with the Airborne.
I was really struck there. One of the guys, and my apologies, I don't remember his name, but he's one of the youngest-looking guys. particularly when he's there all in his military kit and he's wearing his helmet. There are times he looks like he's about 12. And this was the guy who, when you talked to him, talked about how his parents were hippies, and when he was a little boy, they wouldn't let him play with toy guns.
Yeah, his name was Pemble, Misha Pemble Belkin. And, he said his parents were hippies. He grew up in the Northwest, Oregon. He was a snowboarder, a skateboarder, and he joined the Army because he realized he was living out of his car and snowboarding. He just needed some direction in his life. Some of these guys really, I think, benefited from being in that sort of disciplined environment. Some people, I think, react very, very poorly to it, and it doesn't work for them. But Misha, he decided to stay in the Army. He's about to deploy again to Afghanistan. As a civilian, I had this idea of the U.S. military as all being kind of one thing, and I assumed everyone was sort of vaguely conservative politically and from a certain sort of layer of society, and, I couldn't have been more wrong. I mean, there was really the whole crazy American experiment, demographically, in terms of education, income levels, like everybody was in that platoon. It was really an incredible mix of this country.
Did either of you go into this particular assignment, or other time that say you've spent in Afghanistan? And did either of you go into this with some sort of a strong personal feeling about whether this war was a good idea or not?
I think both Sebastian and I mean, we both care deeply about what is happening in Afghanistan. Sebastian has been reporting on Afghanistan since the mid-90s. I've been covering wars and conflicts, often from civilian perspectives. This was my first time embedded with the U.S. military, so I was very interested to see what that experience looked like. I think what we're doing, though, is we're reporters. We're not there to kind of lay out our political opinions and tell you what to think. I mean, I didn't want my political ideas to judge your experience of what it's like. And, what we do in the film is bring you a really full experience of that, of what the soldiers go through. You think you've seen it, but you've only really seen a couple of, network news pieces or the pieces in the opinion pieces in the paper. You haven't seen something where you go on a 90-minute deployment to Afghanistan in all the kind of range and nuance of what the soldiers go through. And so really what we thought, we just didn't want to put in the film. We just wanted you to experience the reality.
I think it's a very powerful film, and I do think it does what you hoped that it would do. And I think you get the feeling, as much as I'm sure you can get with a movie, that you are there. So that, I think in that sense, it certainly was successful, and I would certainly suggest that people try to see it. I still find myself wondering, I don't know, maybe Sebastian Younger, you have some thought about this, still find myself wondering, well, how would it, how do you, whatever you feel about the war or whatever sort of ideas you have about it or about the country, how it is that you manage to keep that a little bit separate from the idea that what you're trying to do here is just be a recorder and try to convey to the people who are watching what the experiences of these men are.
Well, I mean, it is in keeping with my understanding of proper journalism. I mean, every good journalist strives to not put their personal opinion into their work. In this case, my feelings about the war in Afghanistan are very conflicted and quite emotional. And what we wanted this film to be was this, as Tim said, the starting point. We wanted to make a film that would bring everyone across the political spectrum to one table to discuss the war. And, it's easy enough to make a film that condemns war. I mean, that's easy, right? Any realistic film about war ends up looking like it condemns war. That's not that useful at this point. We really need to engage all political parties in this country to figure out what we're doing. And we're in a terrible bind. If we leave Afghanistan, it will go back to the chaos and bloodshed that I saw in the 1990s. The reason NATO troops are tolerated in Afghanistan by the Afghan people is precisely because of that. They know what will happen if NATO leaves. If we stay in Afghanistan, of course, there's a continuing price of bloodshed and the cost to U.S. soldiers and NATO soldiers and the Afghan people. And so we're in this terrible sort of bind. And if we come to a solution as a nation, it will only be because the political parties, conservatives and liberals, abandon their ideologies and their pre-formulated opinions and engage in a realistic dialogue about what the solution is in Afghanistan. And we were hoping to make a film that would sort of was the seed of that conversation.
And I have to say, in the same way, you know, we're not making a kind of a film that glorifies war. I mean, in the film, we have one of the really rare moments the people have never really seen before of what it's like, you know, after an Apache attack helicopter, attacks a house and kills and wounds innocent Afghan civilians. Now, that footage is very rare, and it's included in the film. So we're not shying away from showing, the difficult aspects of war. We're not glorifying just the soldiers' experience. We're actually just trying to show, as Sebastian said, the very difficult and complicated emotional territory that they find themselves in and the difficult and complicated territory that comes out of war. And, you know, it's like if you say in a room of people, like, who disagrees with war, we'll all put our hands up. But I remember very well living in West Africa at the end of the 90s, early 2000s. And in 99, a rebel group invaded Freetown and killed 40,000 people. And the West, the West was focused on Kosovo. Nobody looked at that plight. Nobody intervened until a year later. And the Sierra Leoneans wanted us to intervene. When the U.S. and Britain went into Afghanistan in 2001, the Taliban was a much reviled system that had harbored al-Qaeda, and the al-Qaeda had ended up killing 3,000 people in the States. So I think we went in there with a good reason, but obviously the goalposts have shifted. You know, many of the insurgents now using Pakistan as the rear base. So as Sebastian says, it's like we need the political parties to have a little bit of clarity and come together without the ideological baggage. And we really feel that Restrepo has shifted the paradigm for a discussion about the war.
Well, let me introduce the two guests here. We're about midway through this part of Focus, and we are talking with Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger. Tim Hetherington is a photographer and filmmaker. He has reported on conflict for more than 10 years. He made a documentary about the civil war in Liberia, an Uncivil War. That's the title. He's contributing photographer for Vanity Fair magazine. Sebastian Younger, probably a lot of people will know him for his book, The Perfect Storm. He has reported for Vanity Fair, where he's contributing editor from many war zones across the world. The two of them together spent time. They made 10 trips on assignments for Vanity Fair and ABC News, either together or individually, to the Korangal Valley in Afghanistan. This is a remote area in eastern Afghanistan, a place that at the time was probably the most dangerous place to be in the Afghan war. And they shot a lot of tape, brought back all this material, did some more interviews with the soldiers, and they have taken all this material and put it together into a documentary, and it's called Restrepo. It has been shown in theaters around the country, and it will be shown for the very first time on television next week on Monday, November 29th. This is on the National Geographic Channel, and I believe that's 8 o'clock our time if you would like to see it. Also, by the way, they each have a book now that's based on the reporting that they did there. Tim Hetherington has a book of photographs. The title of that book is Infidel, and Sebastian Younger has also published a book, and that book is titled War. So those books are out there as well. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Did the U.S. military place any restrictions on what you could cover?
They did not at all. Thousands of journalists have been embedded with U.S. troops. It's a novel program instituted by President Bush, and in my mind, as a journalist, it's a good thing. In the Gulf War I, the press was barred from frontline units, and I think in a democracy, that really is not a good way to cover war. And so we embedded, we followed the procedure, and we were placed with this unit, and we were never told by anyone on the ground or higher up what we could or couldn't shoot. No one ever asked to see our footage. We came out with an article in Vanity Fair. We were on assignment for Vanity Fair that included photographs that included civilian casualties, American casualties. We came out with that article in a Nightline report in the middle of our project. Some of the stuff that was in those reports was not necessarily flattering of the U.S. military. We pointed out real problems and what was happening, and no one ever said a thing about it. I was really very very proud of that. I mean, as an American, I was very proud of that, that the government, the military really did not put a hand on us.
How did you approach the problem of showing soldiers who were either wounded or killed?
Well, we just filmed it. I remember being in Operation Rock Avalanche and filming, when the American lines were overrun by insurgents and Larry Ruger was killed. I was with a group of soldiers as they went to counterattack the hill where that attack had happened. We were probably 50 or 80 meters away. And as we ran up, we found, the body of Larry Ruger, who'd been shot in the head and killed. Two guys were wounded. And I carried on filming. And that's my job. And the guys I was with understood that very much, that that was what I was there for. If I wasn't filming, I'm just wasting my time and their time. And, there was a moment of tension when Afghan army guys are trying to drag away Larry by his feet, and his very close friend, Rayon was started screaming at them, stop that, and I was filming, and he said to me, stop filming. I stopped for about a second, 30 seconds or so, I carried on, and later, I was talking to him, and, he apologized. He said, listen, I'm sorry to shout at you that way. I was just absolutely, overcome. And I said, I was also in default. I was just filming. We certainly did stretch. I think we stretched the embed system in a way that hasn't been stretched before. We filmed things and we showed things that the soldiers, were not necessarily seeing. But they appreciated our honesty and the frankness with which we did it. And we did an open-handed manner. We didn't have necessarily an agenda. And that's what allowed us to put the material out there.
I just wonder if you at all had the experience that you shot something. And as you say, if you're a photojournalist, that's what you do. You get it. And that then later, though, when you sat down and looked at it, you looked at it in a different way, or is it possible then at that point to look at it almost like you're looking at it for the first time and being stunned by what you had actually shot?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do that. That's often the case in my work. And you have to react to the material and think about the material that you've got with a kind of responsibility. I remember covering massacres on the Darfur border, for Human Rights Watch, and it was a terrible scene, bringing that material home and realizing that some of that material, it's important to document it. It was important to go there to do that. It was the first documentation of massacres carried out by Janjaweed on the border into Chad. And we had to document it, but it's not necessarily the sort of material that you need to put out for public display on the front page of a newspaper. There are other images that can be used to engage with the public. I'm not there to shock people with my images. I'm there to engage people. If people need the raw documentation, professional, researchers need that information, they can access it. The same thing in Restrepo. I had some very graphic images of both U.S. soldiers and Afghans who have been killed in the course of the war. And, but we used images. We didn't sanitize the film, but we take you on an emotional journey, and you see those people, the people that have died, but you see it in a way that, that both conveys the message and the tragedy of those deaths, but also is respectful to the families of those who have been killed. And it's a very fine line to tread, and it's something that we take very seriously.
All right. We have a couple of callers. Let's talk with them. First in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. One of the questions I have is, by virtue of your being with this combat unit, how does that affect their combat effectiveness when, in the back of their mind, they're not only having to look out for each other, but look out for you guys as well? So is, by virtue of you being there, does that affect the reality on the ground?
I don't think that was in the back of their minds. I mean, there was no individual security in that situation. We were safe if the group was safe, and the soldiers devoted all of their attention to keeping the group safe. I mean, if anything, we might have been the lieutenant's problem, but we had more Tim and I had more combat experience than most of the guys in the platoon because, I've been covering war since 1993. We know how to handle ourselves. We're fit. We're in good shape. We carried our gear. We never fell out on a patrol. We never groused about anything. We just tried to not be a problem. I don't think we ever were a problem. So I think very quickly they assessed us as being fit for that environment, and I don't think they gave us a lot of thought during the firefights.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. This is Champagne, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've read the book as well as seen the documentary, and I don't want to sound like suggesting that a different documentary be made, but I am wondering about, in terms of the book, there were times which I very much found insightful when Sebastian would reflect on what he was witnessing, and I couldn't help noticing that at no time did he reflect that had, say, the Taliban been doing the same thing that he and the photojournalists were doing, they would have a very similar type of documentary and book. And I never got a sense that there was an understanding that the enemy, the Taliban, they were experiencing much of the same things that the our side was experiencing, the doubts, the anxiety, the adrenaline rush, the possibility of injury and death, reflection on families back home. In the book, there was some indication that, you know, there was awareness of what the civilians were experiencing during this combat, but nothing about the enemy. I mean, the enemy was always seen as just that almost non-human obstacle out there. And I wondered if that was deliberate or I guess want to know why that was excluded.
Well, actually, in the book, there's a scene where one of the soldiers is wondering exactly those things.
I don't recall that. I'm sorry.
It's in there. Brendan O'Byrne is saying, what are we doing here? We're trying to kill people, and they're trying to kill us. It's crazy. They're, like, over there on the other side of the valley. And I actually, I talked for a page or so about how weird it is when you start to think about what you're actually doing. I don't mean weird, wrong, just weird.
Right.
And, you know, also, as a journalist, I have no access to the Taliban side. If I try to go over to their side, they'd kill me. And so
But I was thinking that just when you did reflect, I missed that part, but reflecting that, it is weird because the other side is doing the same thing we're doing.
Yep, and I think the other side probably didn't give much thought to the American experience either. I mean, you really can't afford to when you're in a life and death situation, and that is one of the sort of sad ironies of wars is that each side dehumanizes the other as completely as possible in order to do their jobs.
Right. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with Sebastian Junger and Tim Hetherington. The two of them have made a documentary, Restrepo, that won the documentary prize this year at Sundance. It has been shown in theaters around the country. It will have its very first television showing next week on Monday night on the National Geographic Channel, so you'll have an opportunity to see it. Also, based on some of their experiences reporting on combat in Afghanistan, they have each produced books. Tim Hetherington has a book of photographs. The title of the book is Infidel, and then Sebastian Junger has also written the book War. So if you're interested, you can seek those out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 is the number. One of the things that I think is really striking, I was really struck by it, particularly at one point during the film, where at one point they're talking about, someone says, one of the soldiers says, the fear is always there, especially at night. And so it's really clear is that they're very exposed and that they're always vulnerable to attack. And then there's a sequence of fighting. And then the next thing they're doing is they're laughing and they're talking about how exciting it is to be in the firefight, how exhilarating it is. Somebody says, talks about what a rush it is. And I think it's really interesting to have these, kind of butted right up against each other. On the one hand, the fact that you're living in fear all the time, that you could be attacked any time, and this sort of crazy excitement that actually comes with being in the fight.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny. In war, there are so many contradictory kind of emotions and feelings, all kind of rounded out together in an experience. And, you know, we try to convey some of that in the film and in our books, you know. And often back home, people want to kind of simplify it, you know, and make it into very simple statements about war. But as the writer Tim O'Brien says, that you can't do that. Like, war is much more complex than that. You know, and, you know, as I said, we wanted to just convey that reality. And, you know, it's a thing that you grapple with. But I would say about the idea of adrenaline that, sure, there is adrenaline out there. But I think when soldiers come home and, you know, come home back to America and they say, you know, that they miss it out there, I think that what they're saying is also they don't necessarily miss – it's not about the adrenaline. It's really about the significance and meaning that being out there gives their lives. I mean, if you take a 20-year-old guy and you give him a gun, he's in a platoon, he knows his position in that platoon. He knows that he's tasked not to fall asleep on guard duty to protect the other guys. He has his responsibilities, and he really knows his place. And that must be, for a young man, an extremely fulfilling experience. You know, when he comes back to America, I mean, when I was 20, you're at the bottom of the heap again. You know, you don't quite know your place in society. You don't know what's expected of you. And that's a very confusing place to be. So I think the guys at the end really miss that significance and meaning. And the same for us journalists. I think you come out of a situation like that where, you know, covering a really significant event like what was going on in the Korongal gives your reporting a kind of meaning and significance. And you come out of that and you miss that. So it's not just the adrenaline, although obviously that's a part of life out there.
Let's talk with another caller here in Champaign, line number two.
Yes, good morning. I have been reading a bit about Afghanistan and Afghan wars. I read Ahmed Rashid's book on the Taliban. I've read about Pat Tillman. I read The Kite Runner. And I read a book about the British in the first and second Afghan wars during the 19th century. And that gave me a bit of historical perspective. And in reference to the caller who talked about whether the Taliban were reflecting on the other side, but, you know, the same way American soldiers do, my impression from what I have read about the Taliban is that, no, they don't reflect the way Americans do, but they don't think the way we do. There is such a chasm between the cultures, the societies, their educational backgrounds, that we can't think about the Taliban the way we would think about, oh, say, you know, Germans in World War II. I mean, the Germans came from a Western cultural world, whereas the Taliban come from a world that is completely alien to what Americans have experienced. And maybe I don't have a question, but is there a way, or maybe does your film really convey the fact that there is that chasm between that part of the world and our part of the world? And I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you so much for your comments.
All right.
Well, you can tell from our film that it's a very poor and backwards agrarian society. I mean, that's pretty clear. We mustn't confuse the Taliban with the Afghans. The Taliban are a Pashtun movement. There are many ethnic groups in Afghanistan: the Uzbeks, the Tajiks, the Turkmens, the Hazaras, and the Pashtuns. All of those groups fought the Soviet Union when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in 1979. Right now, we are, the United States and the Afghan government are at war with a part of the Pashtun population. And there are, and within the Taliban, there are many different groups. There's, sort of categories. I mean, at the lowest level, there are guys, local guys, who are paid $5 or $10 a day to fight the Americans, and often they get killed. They don't know what they're doing. They're fighting, and I think in large part because they need a job. It's a very poor country. You climb up the scale. There's sort of organized crime groups that move opium or timber. They have an investment in repelling the rule of law and government. They become incorporated into the Taliban. Then you have the sort of ideological components: Pakistani fighters, foreign fighters, Arabs who come in, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's group, the Haqqani network. There are Chechens that come in, very, very tough, very well-trained fighters. So you can't really generalize about the state of mind of the Taliban because that comprises so many different things, so many different motivations. again, from an ideological one all the way down to simply $5 a day. And to make matters worse, journalists have almost no access to the Taliban, or at least Western journalists don't, because they'll be killed or taken captive. So it really did relegate us to trying to portray the soldiers' reality and allowing the other side, if people are interested in that perspective, you know, you really have to sort of chase that down on your own from reporters who Muslim reporters, Afghan or Pakistani reporters who have some contact with the Taliban itself.
Well, they, you know, what I found myself, one of the things I found myself thinking about, particularly when watching those places in the film where the American soldiers are trying to talk with the local people about all of the different barriers here that exist to them being able to talk to one another. First of all, there's a language barrier. I'm sure that there are cultural barriers. Here we have people who live there, and it's a rough place, and looks like for a lot of people it's kind of a hardscrabble existence. So these Americans are coming from a different place. Eventually they're going to leave, and the Afghan people are going to have to deal with it, whatever problems that they leave behind. And here the Americans are trying to say to the Afghans, we're here to help you. And this is and try to explain to them why it is they are here. And I wonder, as you sat there and you watched that, what was there, in fact, communication? Did they understand one another, particularly did the Afghan people really understand what the Americans were doing there?
Well, I think the Afghan people, you know, are very practical people too. And, you know, in some ways, although culture may divide us, there are things like, you know, everybody wants security, everyone wants, you know, jobs and education for their children. And we went into Afghanistan in 2001 to break up the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, and because of what happened here in the U.S. And we had a very easy victory over there at first. And the problem was we pulled out, we shifted focus onto Iraq, and we left behind 19,000 soldiers. I mean, there's 40,000 cops in New York City. I mean, if that was sending a message really to the Afghan people that we weren't really serious about their security, they didn't. You know, what do you do if you're a local villager and the U.S. is saying, well, side with us, but then there's not enough manpower or resources in it to really get that security? You know that if you go onto the U.S. side, that when they do leave, that you'll get your head cut off by the Taliban. So the locals were in a very tough spot, but what they did want is they wanted peace and security. And they were realistic that, as you said, the Americans would eventually leave, and they did leave the Congo in April this year. Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated situation. But I would point out, if you look at civilian casualties, obviously an important marker when one is considering the war, and if you look at those figures, the topmost figures of Afghan civilian casualties since 2001, since the invasion or since the intervention, is 30,000. And that's a terrible figure, 30,000 innocent people killed as a direct consequence of the war. But that's nothing compared to the 400,000 that died the decade earlier. And those are Human Rights Watch figures. 400,000 people died when the Taliban and the Northern Alliance and the warlords fought in the 90s. And that's nothing compared to the million to million and a half that died under the Soviet rule. So in a weird kind of way, Afghan civilians are having the least amount of civilian casualties they've known since the late 70s. That figure has to come down. But, if we pull out now, there's a good chance, and I've heard this from many Afghans, that things will spiral back to the 90s, and that's something we definitely want to avoid.
At one point, one of the soldiers that you talked to, and this is back and when you're doing the after the deployment is over and the interviews that you did with him in Italy, clearly he is making a reference to combat stress, the effect of being in this place every day with that level of uncertainty, that level of threat, being in firefights, never quite knowing when you might be attacked. He says something along the lines of, well, they really don't know what to do with us. That is, maybe, and seems to be suggesting there that this level of combat stress, this many people who have it, is different, somewhat different than what the military has had to deal with before, based on the circumstances, based on long deployments and whatever else. I wonder if you came away with a feeling for just how much of a psychological issue it was, and then how well the military was trying to address that need of these soldiers.
Well, the unit we were with was in a lot of combat. They were in, you know, something like 400 firefights. It was way more than probably any other company in the U.S. military that, in those years. And they were studied when they got back, and they didn't come home. I mean, these are professional soldiers. They went back to their base in Italy. They got to go home for a month, and they returned. They reported for duty in Italy. They trained up for another year, and they did another deployment that they just finished a couple of weeks ago. And the Army has studied them because they haven't had a group of men who were in 400 firefights in 1 year. I mean, it's an enormous amount. I don't know what conclusions they came to. Obviously, the U.S. military, like any bureaucracy, is sort of slow to respond to things, and they respond, you know, it takes them a while to figure it out, and then once they figure it out, that's their solution until another better solution comes along. And I think the military obviously is very concerned about PTSD. It's very costly in every sense, and I think they're trying to figure it out, but it's also a complex problem. I mean, look, you know, if your high school kid saw his best friend hit by a car and killed, I mean, a very traumatic thing for an 18-year-old, there's no pill, there's no kind of counseling that's just going to make that pain go away. He's going to be with your 18-year-old for the rest of his life. The soldiers are no different. So, you know, life is not undoable, and a certain amount of this scarring is, I don't think really there is a solution to it. That's one of the tragedies of war.
The two of you have had a lot of experience covering conflict. I can't give you very much time to answer the question, but how has this changed you?
I mean, war is traumatic, as Sebastian was saying, and it leaves its scars. But also, we're a bit older than the soldiers we were with, and we've over the years built up a support mechanism, a way to work through the kind of issues that it arises. And you know, not belittling trauma, but you know, the people have car crashes in the States, or they lose loved ones, they lose children, they have their own traumatic events to deal with, and we're no different to that. We have to work through it, and but it stays with you. It stays with you, and it's something, you know. But what stays with me more than the trauma was the profound relationships I developed with these guys and the understanding for their situation, which is a very tricky one. And I hope people come see the film to kind of understand it better.
Well, there we're going to have to stop. The film we're talking about is Restrepo. It will have its television premiere next Monday, the 29th, 8 o'clock Central Time for us here in this part of the country. It's being shown on the National Geographic Channel, a film made by our guests Tim Hetherington, Sebastian Younger. Also, you can look for Tim Hetherington's book of photographs from this experience, and also Sebastian Younger's book, War. Tim Hetherington, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having us on.
And Sebastian Younger, thank you.
My pleasure.